Hello, I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. Here are the obituaries from today's Des Moines Register. Florence Alberta Anderson, aged 100, of Ankeny, died July 25th. Arrangements by Hamilton's Funeral Home. Christy Groen, aged 55, of Arvada, Colorado, died July 27th. Arrangements by Boak Funeral Home in Hubbard. Helen Henderson, aged 98, of Colfax, died July 25th. Arrangements by Coburn. Marcia Keel, aged 72, of Des Moines, died July 26th. Tiana M. Overton, aged 9, of Sheraton, died July 25th. Arrangements by Overton Funeral Home. Robert Rickers, aged 86, of Westside, died July 24th. Arrangements by Huebner Funeral Home. George Simmer, known as Mike, aged 71, of Des Moines, died July 22nd. Arrangements by Hamilton's Southtown Funeral Home. James D. Williams, aged 77, of Sheraton, died July 26th. Arrangements by Fielding Funeral Home. Gary D. Hector, aged 83, of Des Moines, passed away July 21st at the Urbandale Health Care Center in Urbandale. He was born on February 15th, 1937, in Des Moines to Margaret Court and Donald Hector. Gary graduated from Des Moines Tech High School in 1956 and proudly served in the United States Marine Corps for 2 years until 1958. He retired from John Deere after 30 years. Gary enjoyed playing cribbage, betting on horse races, playing pool, and was especially fond of his Lincoln Continentals. Gary is survived by his sons, Michael Hector and Mark and Terry Hector, 3 grandchildren and 5 great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents, Margaret and Donald. Funeral services will be held at Hamilton's on Westtown Parkway in West Des Moines on Thursday, July 30th at 10 a.m. A private graveside service will take place at Glendale Cemetery. Online condolences may be expressed at www.hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. The Honorable Judge Joel D. Novak, aged 80, died Sunday, July 26th at his home in Des Moines. The family will receive friends from 9 to 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, July 28th at Isles Dunn's Chapel. A graveside service will follow at 11 a.m. at Glendale Cemetery. Joel's service will be live-streamed as well. A link to the service will be available 10 minutes prior on Joel's obituary page of the website www.islescares.com. Judge Joel D. Novak was born in Rock Island, Illinois on March 8, 1940, where he grew up in the midst of an extended family. Joel graduated from the University of Iowa's Law School with his Juris Doctorate degree in June 1965. Joel practiced as a civil law trial lawyer for 14 years until he was appointed by Governor Robert D. Ray as a 5th Judicial District Court trial judge in August 1979. Joel just loved being a judge. Joel's commitment to justice, compassion, integrity, and a clear interpretation of the law made him one of Des Moines' finest judges. It was not unusual for someone to approach him on the street to thank him for ruling equitably from the bench. He was always surprised by such expressions of kindness. Sadly, Joel's passing took place on Sunday, July 26th. He is preceded in death by his mother, Frieda Denger, known as Babe, and stepfather, Charles Denger, known as Chubb, his father, Sam Novak, and stepmother, Dorothy Novak, and maternal grandparents, Lillian and Reuben Leibowitz, along with his mother, helped to raise him. Joel was survived by his treasured wife, Kay True Bradley Novak, beloved children, Lisa Novak and Ashley Collins, Jolie Novak and Alan Carroll, Jason Novak and Josh Novak, grandchildren, Sasha Collins and Sadie Carroll, brothers Steve and Chris Novak, and Jeff Novak, sister-in-law, Ann Bradley Herman and Terry, brother-in-law, Sid Brad Bradley, his nieces and nephews, his close cousins with whom he grew up in Rock Island, and many dear friends and colleagues. Joel will be greatly missed by all. Memorial contributions may be made to Hope Ministries, Wounded Warriors, or Christ Life Ministries. Online condolences are welcome at www.islescares.com. Lennis Hart, known as Lenny, was a wonderful, loving husband, grandpa, stepdad, brother, and uncle. On Friday, July 24th, the angels came to take him home after a short battle with cancer. He loved to eat, watch TV, and do puzzle books. He also loved being with his family and his doggy Angel. Lenny will be missed so very much by his family and friends. He is survived by his wife, Mary, daughter, Tammy Bates, son, Todd and Lisa Gibson, 6 sisters, 3 brothers, and 7 grandchildren. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. on Friday, July 31st, at Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens on 60th Avenue in Des Moines, with burial at Ankeny Memorial Gardens. Visitation will be held Thursday evening at the funeral home from 5 to 7 p.m. Online condolences may be expressed at www.hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Kathy Joanne Allen joined our Father in Heaven July 20th, age 63, from natural causes. We'll post on Facebook the Celebration of Life event. Norma Jean Perry, aged 89, passed away Saturday, July 25th, at Mercy One Medical Center in Des Moines. The family will receive friends from 5 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, July 29th, at Westover Funeral Home in Des Moines. Burial will take place at 11 a.m. Thursday, July 30th, at Liberty Cass Township Cemetery. Norma was born November 23rd, 1930, in Woodward, Iowa, to Lloyd and Minnie Waltz Lincoln. She married Glenn Perry on September 27, 1952, in her parents' home. Norma worked in vocational rehab at the Woodward Resource Center for 32 years, retiring in 1988. She was a member of the Woodward Legion Auxiliary. She was most well known for her cooking. You never left her home hungry and always had multiple choices to pick from. All guests in her home were treated with kindness and hospitality. Norma enjoyed reading, needlework, antiques, camping, gardening, and canning. She also liked making ceramics, fishing, and traveling. Her favorite outside of cooking was spending time with her family, especially her grandchildren. Her family always came first. She will be greatly missed by all those that knew and loved her. Contributions may be made for a future memorial. Online condolences will be welcomed at islescares.com. Peg Minier, aged 88, of Des Moines, died Friday, July 24th, at Ramsey Village with her husband, Al Minier, at her side. Born Margaret Louise Burke, she always went by Peg. On March 26, 1932, she was born in Independence to James, Leo, and Grace Marie Cook Burke. She was raised in Hazleton, Iowa, along with her brother James Burke. She graduated from Hazleton High School, excelling on the basketball court. Peg attended Iowa State Teachers College, graduating with a teacher's certificate. During her teaching career, she taught elementary students in Eldon, Ottumwa, and finally Des Moines. Peg dedicated her life to caring for her children, her husband, and sons, in addition to her children at school. She was a charter member of St. Mary of Nazareth Catholic Church, as well as a member of the church's Ladies Club. She was active with the Des Moines Women's Club. She also volunteered with Iris Radio for the Blind, the Bishop Drum Home, and the Des Moines Schools. Survivors include husband Albert Dean Minier, sons Tom Minier and Nick, and Carrie Davis Minier, and brother James Burke. Mass of Christian burial will be 10 a.m. Thursday, July 30th, at St. Mary of Nazareth Catholic Church, 4600 Meredith Drive in Des Moines, with interment at Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Van Meter immediately following. Norma Angeline Side Reed of Pleasant Hill went to be with her Lord and Savior Jesus Christ on Friday, July 24th, at the age of 85. Services will be held Saturday, August 1st, at Eastside Church of the Nazarene at 1451 East 25th Street in Des Moines. Visitation will begin at 9:30 a.m., followed by her funeral service at 10:30 a.m. Burial will take place at Avon Cemetery. There will be a luncheon at the church after the burial. The service may be attended virtually at the website dsmeastside.org/livestream. Memorial contributions may be directed to East Side Church of the Nazarene in Des Moines. She will be lovingly remembered by her brother, Lawrence Side, many nieces and nephews, and countless friends. Norma was preceded in death by her husband, Rodney Reed, sisters Pauline Prawl and Lois Hunter, and her brother, Wayne Willett. Norma had a strong faith and visited with the Lord daily through devotion and prayer. She was a longtime member of East Side Church of the Nazarene and loved serving her Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Norma lived life to its fullest. She was very fun-loving and had a great sense of humor. She will be remembered as an accomplished pianist, a fabulous cook, and for her enjoyment of thrift store shopping. She always put others first, had a multitude of friends, and will always hold the title of favorite aunt. Condolences may be expressed at www.hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Larry R. Kiefer, aged 77, of Des Moines, passed away on July 25th at Taylor House Hospice House after a year-long battle against stage 4 colon cancer. Larry was born in a farmhouse in Wachier, Iowa, on April 16, 1943. He was the second of seven children born to Lawrence, and Alita Bunting Kiefer. He graduated from Hedrick High School in 1961 and immediately entered the service of the U.S. Marine Corps. Larry was trained in electronics, radar, with emphasis on surveillance pictures and counterintelligence blocking, and helicopter maintenance on Navy carriers. He was stationed in Japan, North Carolina, and Vietnam. In his lifetime, he was diagnosed with three different cancers, two of which were directly related to the chemical Agent Orange sprayed around the Da Nang Air Force Base. In 1967, he returned to civilian life. He attended classes at Ottumwa Heights Community College under the GI Bill, where he continued his military training with electronics. In 1969, Larry married Jill Adele Edmondson, deceased in 1977. From this marriage, two children were born, Todd Michael Kiefer, who died in 1987, and Melissa Jo Kiefer. In 1982, Larry married Janice Stevenson Garland Kiefer. Jan brought two children to their blended family, Karen Jean Garland and David Dean Garland. For 28 years, Larry was employed by Fisher Controls, Emerson. His employment was located in Marshalltown and Austin, Texas. He began his work there as an electronics technician and ended his career as an associate engineer. In retirement, he worked for Visiting Nurses Services as a transportation assistant. Larry was a man of boundless energy. He loved to bike, hike, downhill ski, and work out. When neighbors needed help with outside yard work, he enjoyed taking care of those chores for them. A low-hanging tree branch anywhere would always be trimmed, hence his nickname, Larry the Lopper. Watching for deer and eating ice cream were two of his favorite pastimes. He enjoyed traveling, spending time at Okoboji and winters in Wasalco, Texas. In May 2019, Larry was honored to fly to Washington, D.C. on a veteran honor flight out of Des Moines. The trip was one of the highlights of his life. Larry was a man of deep religious faith. He felt his life was blessed and filled with many good fortunes, for which he was very grateful. Services will be held at Holy Trinity Catholic Church in the Beaverdale area of Des Moines on Thursday, July 30th. Visitation will be at 9:30 a.m., followed by funeral service at 10:30. Private graveside services with military honors will be held at the Ottumwa Cemetery in Ottumwa. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Muscular Dystrophy Association or the American Cancer Society. For those unable to attend the funeral, a live stream link will be available just prior to the service on Larry's obituary page at www.islescares.com, where you may also leave online condolences. And that concludes the obituaries in today's Register. And again, we'll conclude with just a brief moment of silence in memory of Peg Minear, who was a reader for Iris. Turning now to the sports section of the Des Moines Register, we'll begin by concluding a promise made yesterday to wrap up the nine remaining 9 baseball players to watch at the 2020 State Baseball Tournament. We read the first 9 listed alphabetically yesterday. Here are the second 9, again listed alphabetically. As reported by Cody Goodwin. Gable Mitchell, a sophomore from Iowa City High, one of the nation's top shortstops and perhaps the best in-state baseball talent in the 2022 class. Mitchell is hitting .439 this summer with 3 triples and 16 RBI. He is also Dan Gable's grandson. Jackson Payne, a senior from Waukee, an Iowa signee and the ace of Waukee's pitching staff with a 0.76 ERA over 36.2 innings pitched. Payne has a fastball that can hit 90 and a curveball that has helped him strike out 57 this summer. Anthony Potthoff, a senior from Van Meter, a hard-throwing righty who can hit the mid-80s with his fastball but can also sling a curveball, slider, and changeup in the low 70s, posted a 1.27 ERA over 38.2 innings this summer and is also hitting .359. Logan Smith, a senior from Dallas Center Grimes, a South Dakota State commit with a 0.30 ERA and 72 strikeouts over 47 innings this summer. He has a strong fastball, a curveball, and a changeup, a strong arm in the outfield, too. Kellen Strohmeyer, a sophomore from Dubuque Hempstead. Kellen is a North Carolina commit and another one of the nation's top shortstops. He's hitting .370 this summer with 4 doubles, 2 triples, and a home run. He's a quick, athletic defender and on the base paths. Gabe Swanson, a junior from Johnston. Gabe is a Nebraska commit and perhaps the best bat on Class 4A's top-ranked team, hitting .423 with 8 doubles, 3 triples, 4 home runs, and 30 RBI. He's a smooth defensive shortstop, too. Doug Taylor, a freshman from Mason City Newman, an Iowa commit and one of the country's best overall 2023 players. Top 50 pitching prospect nationally, according to Perfect Game. He has a 0.54 ERA over 26 innings pitched this summer. Jacob Wolver, a junior from Johnston, is a do-it-all star who's hitting .345 with 23 RBI and 3 home runs. But even more impressive, he hasn't allowed a run all summer in 20 innings pitched. And finally, Daniel Wright, a senior from Sergeant Bluff Luton. A Wisconsin football recruit, the 6'7" righty is a heck of a pitcher, too, with a 0.75 ERA over 37.1 innings this summer and has the Warriors back at state for just the 5th time in school history. And today, Cody Goodwin reports on the state baseball tournament progress. Yesterday, 2A top seed advances with walk-off win in the 8th. Van Meter gets past Trainer in extras. Mike Kennedy watched closely as the ball shot off Jack Pettit's bat in the bottom of the 8th inning. Bryce Cole had taken a few steps off second base, but Kennedy, Van Meter's baseball coach, didn't care. He wanted to see the ball land first. Quote, "I hope to God it's fair," Kennedy said. "We had hit some balls hard to right field, just one at him. I was hoping that would be the one that got outside his glove," end quote. The ball dropped inside the white line, a fair ball, and provided the extra inning, walk-off hit necessary for top-ranked Van Meter to beat number 8 Trainer 1-0 in Monday's first Class 2A state baseball quarterfinal at Principal Park. The rest of the Bulldog players erupted from the dugout. Van Meter, state champs a year ago and now 21-2 this summer, advances to Thursday's semifinal round. Kennedy took in the sight and smiled. A year ago, as the Bulldogs won 34 games and their first state baseball title since 2003, he was a couple thousand miles away in California. As Van Meter blanked North Lynn in the final, Kennedy was participating in a field exercise while serving an 18-month deployment with the U.S. Army. He caught the highlights online later that night and became overjoyed at the sight of the result. He had coached the Bulldogs to the 2018 state semifinals, losing to Iowa City Regina, then left shortly after for California. Co-coach Eben Baumhofer called Kennedy regularly to update him on all things Van Meter athletics. The football team went 11-1 and reached the state semifinals in 2018, then went 12-1 and reached the state championship game in 2019. The basketball team went 22-4 and made it to the state semifinals in 2019, then won another 21 games this past season. Those teams were composed of mostly the same athletes who won the baseball state title in 2019 and another 20 games this summer to earn the number one seed at this week's state tournament. Quote, "It's been a privilege," Kennedy said. "It's been a gift. They've given me a lot more than I could give to them. I was part of the program, but then I left, and they welcomed me back with open arms. It's been pretty special to come back and have this kind of success," end quote. Kennedy returned to Iowa in mid-March, right as the novel coronavirus pandemic gripped the country and brought sports to a halt. The Iowa boys' state basketball tournament finished with limited fan attendance. Spring sports were canceled outright. Still, Kennedy was optimistic about playing ball this summer. Governor Kim Reynolds greenlit baseball and softball's return in late May. Practices began June 1st, followed by games on June 15th. The Bulldogs opened against Pleasantville and won 6-1 to begin their title defense. Last year's Van Meter team was a wrecking ball, outscoring its three state tournament opponents by a combined 26-7. This season's crop of Bulldogs needed some mental fortitude to survive Monday's quarterfinal against Trainer with a record of 12-8. A pitcher's duel broke out between Van Meter's Anthony Potthoff and Trainer's Drew Peterson. Potthoff was pulled after 113 pitches. He struck out 13 and didn't allow a hit over 6 2/3 innings. Peterson left after 5 complete, allowing 1 hit and fanning 6. Quote, "I was just relying on a knee-high fastball, slider, and upper curve," Potthoff said. "The off-speed pitches were working well today. They saw a lot of them," end quote. Then came the bottom of the 8th. Cole reached on a fielding error and advanced to second on Zach Plegencool's sacrifice bunt. Up came Pettit, who poked a single down the right field line, allowing Cole to score. Quote, "I knew I needed a base hit," Pettit said. "I saw an outside pitch and went with it. That right fielder was making great plays all day long, but I got it down the line and it worked out," end quote. Van Meter is now back in the semifinals, the same spot they finished before Kennedy left after the 2018 state tournament. But he feels this team is different. Experienced, sure, but also motivated, not just to repeat, but to honor a lost friend, too. Harrison Smith was a member of last year's state championship baseball team. He didn't play often, registering just 2 at-bats and playing time in 4 games, but he was an integral part of the team's culture that led to so much athletic success. Smith, a Van Meter senior, died February 3rd. He was a quiet kid who loved video games and poker. He helped mentor the children in his mother's kindergarten class and was a proud member of Van Meter's basketball and baseball programs. 4 days after Smith's death, the Van Meter boys basketball team wore T-shirts displaying number 25, Smith's baseball number, ahead of its game against Madrid. On Monday, the Bulldog players and coaches wore a blue number 25 shirt during warm-ups and underneath their white game jerseys as a nod to their friend. Quote, "He's with us every game," Potthoff said. "He was with us a little bit extra today," end quote. And with that, we turn to girls softball and Cody Goodwin's article from yesterday, wrapping up the final 9 listed alphabetically top softball players to watch in the 2020 high school state tournament. Riley Moss, a junior from Muscatine. Moss is right behind Etherington for the state's batting title, hitting .662 this summer with 12 RBI and 6 triples. Also a defensive stalwart in center field with no errors so far this season. Maddie Utzman, a freshman from Waukee. Perhaps the state's next great pitching star, Utzman has posted a 0.40 ERA over 34.2 innings this summer. She's allowed 4 runs total, 2 earned. She's pretty good at the plate, too, hitting .571 in limited appearances. Kennedy Preston, a senior from Carlisle. Last year, Preston slapped a 2-run walk-off home run in the state's semifinals. This summer, she's been just as electric, hitting .508 with 22 RBI and 3 home runs for the top-ranked Wildcats. Haley Sanders, a senior from Loiza Muscatine. Northern Iowa signee and another versatile player for one of the 2A's best softball programs. Sanders is hitting .429 this summer with 25 RBI and has also posted a 0.81 ERA with 149 strikeouts over 95 innings. Jamie Scheck, a junior from Cedar Rapids Kennedy. Jamie is a Drake commit and one of 5A's best pitchers. She posted a .55 ERA, is allowing a .122 average, and has struck out 58 over 51 innings pitched. She's allowed 4 runs all summer. Logan Schnetzer, a senior from Fort Dodge. Class 5A's RBI leader with 45 to go along with 9 home runs and a .500 batting average. Fort Dodge's career home run leader at 34 and counting. Ella Schultz, a junior from Ankeny Centennial. The best bat on a Centennial team that's qualified for state for the first time ever. Ella is hitting .545 with 41 RBI, 18 doubles, and a home run this summer. Olivia Wardlow, a junior from Davenport Assumption. Olivia is an Iowa State commit, hitting .427 with 14 RBI, 8 doubles, and 2 home runs for the second-seeded Knights. She has also stolen 21 bases in 22 attempts. Heidi Wheeler, a junior from Waukee, is a Drake commit. She's hitting .444 with 19 RBI, 8 doubles, 4 triples, and a home run. Heidi is quick on the base paths, too, with 22 stolen bases in 26 attempts. Matthew Bain of the Register reports on today's sports page. Yesterday was 5A day in girls softball at the state tournament. Ankeny Centennial upended Waukee. It took a while for the offense to get going, but the fifth-seeded Ankeny Centennial softball team rallied from a late 2-run deficit to upend number 4 Waukee 5-2 on Monday afternoon at the Iowa State softball tournament. Maddie Huseman tossed a complete game with her 2 earned runs allowed on 9 hits. Both those runs came in the first inning, and Waukee kept that 2-0 lead until the top of the 6th. Centennial, with a record of 22-8, then scored 2 runs to tie the game 2-2, and it followed with 3 more runs in the top of the 7th for the victory. Quote, "They're just in the never panic mode," Centennial head coach Brett Delaney said. "They found a way to get it done, and just the small things we took advantage of tonight, that's a very good Waukee squad we saw. Very impressive. The girls are always believing. We talk about making the routine plays and finding ways to execute, and they executed what we needed to tonight. We got a little lucky on a couple plays. I know we're going to face good competition all week long up here, so we're just excited to get the opportunity to continue to play." End quote. Ella Schultz's 2-run home run in the 6th tied the game. The Jaguars small-balled their way to 3 seventh-inning runs. Centennial logged 4 hits total compared with Waukee's 9. The Warriors had opportunities to bolster their lead throughout the game, but they left 6 runners on base, and Centennial's defense made some great plays, too. Quote, "I feel great. My defense made some really great plays behind me today, and I just pitched my hardest," Huseman said. "They always found a way to help us out. Even when there were runners on, they found a way to make a great play and get those runners out, and we went and got the momentum back," end quote. Centennial's Franny Burnett went 1-for-4 with 2 runs scored and an RBI. Mackenzie James went 2-for-3 with a run scored. For Waukee, with a record of 23-5, Ava Smith and Michaela Hannum knocked in the first 2 inning runs. Ellie Bates allowed 4 runs, 1 earned, over 6 innings, and Maddie Etzman allowed 1 unearned run in her 1 inning of work. Centennial will play top-seeded Fort Dodge with a record of 27-3 Wednesday afternoon in the Class 5A semifinals. Quote, "Fort Dodge has been one of the top teams in the state of Iowa all year, and we knew it coming in," Delaney said. "We're just excited to get the opportunity to compete against them and be on the same field as them. Our girls will be ready, and they'll be excited to play," end quote. And wrapping up yesterday's softball action, Matthew Bain of the Register reports, 5A defending champion Valley ousted. There won't be a title defense in this year's Class 5A state softball tournament. West Des Moines Valley, this year's number 3 seed and the defending state champion, lost 3-1 to number 6 Muscatine in Monday's state quarterfinal round. The Tigers were outhit 11-3. And when they did get runners on base, they often failed to get those runners home, leaving 7 stranded through the game. Quote, "You've got to execute when you have opportunities," Valley head coach Tom Bakey said. "We've popped up too many bunts, and we just didn't have enough quality at-bats when it mattered. We'll congratulate Muscatine. They played very, very well. If they hadn't made their own mistakes, they probably would have scored 7 or 8 runs. We were very fortunate to even be in it at 3-1. We just didn't get the type of quality at-bats we've been getting all year, and that credit goes to them, end quote. Tigers leadoff hitter Alex Honnold went 2-for-2 with a run scored. The rest of Valley's lineup went 1-for-22. Abigail White pitched 5 2/3 innings for the Tigers, who have a record of 23-5, allowing the 3 earned runs on 9 hits while striking out 2. Lauren Fodry pitched the final 1 1/3 innings, and Maura Chalupa pitched 4 1/3 innings for the Muskies with a record of 19-2, allowing 1 earned run on 2 hits while striking out 2. Bree Seaman pitched the final 2 2/3 innings, striking out 3 Tigers while allowing 1 hit. Quote, I think this season was more about emotional healing for a lot of those seniors because they just didn't get a chance to finish up their year the way that they wanted to with school and everything. So I'm pleased, Bakey said. Are we disappointed? Sure, we're disappointed we lost. But in the grand scheme of things, the fact that we got to have 2/3 of a season, we got to compete for a state title, I'm thrilled. I'm just absolutely thrilled for our kids. And you know what? We'll take it. End quote. Muscatine advances to play number 2 Cedar Rapids Kennedy, which has a record of 24-1, at 11 a.m. Thursday in the 5A semifinals. In national sports news, the Associated Press reports in USA Today that according to Dr. Anthony Fauci, the Marlins' coronavirus outbreak could endanger MLB season. The Miami Marlins' coronavirus outbreak could endanger the Major League Baseball season, Dr. Anthony Fauci said Tuesday, although he doesn't believe games need to stop now. More than a dozen Marlins players and staff members tested positive for COVID-19, stranding the team in Philadelphia and raising anew questions about MLB's attempts to conduct a season. Quote, this could put it in danger, said Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert. Quote, I don't believe they need to stop, but we just need to follow this and see what happens with other teams on a day-by-day basis, end quote. Fauci made his comments on ABC's Good Morning America. Quote, Major League Baseball, the players, the owners, the managers have put a lot of effort into getting together and putting protocols that we feel would work, Fauci said. It's very unfortunate what happened with the Miami Marlins, end quote. Their outbreak continued to disrupt Major League Baseball's schedule Tuesday, the 6th day of the pandemic-delayed season, with the Marlins' home game against Baltimore postponed. The game Monday between those two teams was also called off, as was the Yankees' series opener Monday at Philadelphia, where New York would have been in the same clubhouse the Marlins used last weekend. At least 14 players and staff members tested positive for COVID-19, a high-ranking MLB official told USA Today Sports. The official spoke on the condition of anonymity due to the confidential nature of the information. Quote, obviously, we don't want any player to get exposed. It's not a positive thing, Commissioner Rob Manfred said on the MLB Network. Quote, but I don't see it as a nightmare. We think we can keep people safe and continue to play, end quote. The Orioles, who made a trip to Miami without playing a game, are scheduled to host the Marlins in a 2-game series starting Wednesday. Quote, if the testing results are acceptable, the Marlins will resume play in Baltimore on Wednesday against the Orioles, Manfred said. Meanwhile, Chicago White Sox manager Rick Renteria will be kept away from his team after experiencing a, quote, slight cough and nasal congestion, end quote, general manager Rick Hahn said. Tests were planned. The Marlins' outbreak was the talk of baseball, and Washington Nationals manager Dave Martinez choked on his words as he discussed the situation. Martinez missed time last season because of a heart condition, and the Nationals are scheduled to play in Miami this weekend. Quote, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm scared, Martinez said. My level of concern went from about an 8 to a 12. I mean, this thing really hits home now. I got guys in our clubhouse that are really concerned as well, end quote. The Marlins placed infielder Garrett Cooper, outfielder Harold Ramirez, and right-hander Jose Ureña on the injured list. They claimed right-hander Justin Schaefer and left-handed Josh Smith off waivers from Cincinnati and will likely rely heavily on reinforcements from their training camp in Jupiter, Florida. Manfred said there are factors that would force the MLB to alter plans. Quote, a team losing a number of players that rendered it completely non-competitive would be an issue that we would have to address and have to think about making a change, he said. Whether that was shutting down part of the season, the whole season, that depends on the circumstances. Same thing with respect to league-wide. You get to a certain point league-wide where it does become a health threat, and we certainly would shut down at that point, end quote. MLB and the union held talks Monday after aspects of the protocols were widely ignored during the season's first 4 days, such as the prohibitions on high fives and other physical celebrations. The NBA and NHL plan to resume their seasons in bubble environments with basketball at Lake Buena Vista, Florida, and hockey at Edmonton, Alberta, in Toronto. Quote, the NBA and the NHL have an advantage. Smaller numbers of players, shorter period of time, Manfred said. I understand why they did what they did. I'm just not sure it was workable for us. End quote. The NFL has opted not to create a bubble environment as training camps open for the coming season. Quote, it might be that they have to go in a bubble, Fauci said, but I think they're conscientious enough and want to protect their players and protect the personnel that they will do the right thing. End quote. Turning now to the Iowa Life section of the Des Moines Register, Sarah K. LeBlanc reports, the week that should have been punctuated by the sound of thousands of wheels spinning into the Mississippi River instead ended without the traditional joyous exclamations of jubilee. Although the Register's annual Great Bike Ride Across Iowa was canceled this year, we suggest filling the hole the ride's absence made in your hearts with food. Whether you're a virtual rider or spending would-be RagBri week at home, these recipes will get you in the spirit of the ride. And here are just a few of those. How about a malted milk shake? The ingredients include 3 scoops of mint chocolate chip ice cream, 1/4 cup malted milk powder, 3 fluid ounces of whole milk, 1/4 cup of whipped cream, and 2 tablespoons of chopped milk balls. Add the mint chocolate chip ice cream, the malted milk powder, and the milk to a 30-ounce stainless steel malt cup. Blend them together using a spindle until smooth. Pour into a serving glass, top with whipped cream, and garnish with malted milk balls. Here's another recipe, Lytton, Iowa's Marlene Glassnap Rhubarb Pie. This includes 4 cups of rhubarb diced, 1.5 cups of sugar, 1/3 cup flour, and 2 to 3 eggs beaten. Mix those ingredients together and put in an unbaked crust. Top with another crust or strips and bake 15 minutes at 400 degrees, then 30 minutes at 350 degrees or until brown. That sounds so easy, and yet I bet it's really hard. And here are 2 more recipes. Salted caramel lemon and cola float. The ingredients for this include 2 tablespoons of lemon meringue, 2 scoops of Blue Bunny Salted Caramel Craze Premium Ice Cream, and 1 can of cola. Rim the fountain glass with lemon meringue. Scoop the sea salt caramel bunny Blue Bunny ice cream into a glass and pour the cola over the ice cream. I can do that. And to step away from the desserts, our final recipe is a Farm Kids Breakfast Burrito. To serve 6, you would use 6 flour tortillas, 2 cups of frozen potato cubes, 2 tablespoons of butter, 1 cup cooked and crumbled breakfast sausage, 6 slices of cooked and crumbled bacon, 12 scrambled eggs, 1/2 cup milk, and 1/2 teaspoon of salt. Toppings could include salsa, sour cream, diced fresh yellow onion, jalapenos, fresh or canned, finely shredded yellow cheddar cheese, and hot sauce. First, stack the tortillas and wrap them in foil and place in a 350-degree oven for 10 minutes until heated through. Then, in a nonstick skillet, melt the butter over medium heat. Place the potatoes in the pan and shake the pan until the potato cubes are covered in butter. Cook them until they're golden brown on all sides, flipping the potatoes as needed. The less the potatoes are stirred, the better. Extra crispy, unmashed potato cubes are achieved by flipping them in the pan instead of stirring. If you have stopped to watch us cook on RagBri, you will see us flipping our potatoes. Remove them from the heat and keep them warm. Next, whisk the eggs, milk, and salt in a bowl. In a large skillet, cook the eggs until they're firmly scrambled, folding and stirring constantly on medium heat to avoid sticking and browning. Once the eggs are no longer in a liquid state, chop with spatula to finely scramble it to finely scrambled. And eggs that are a drier consistency, remove them from a heat. Then divide the eggs evenly among the tortillas, placing eggs in the center. Top with the potatoes, sausage, bacon crumbles, and the desired amounts of the various toppings. Then fold up the burrito from the bottom, then wrap the sides into the middle, leaving the top open. Wrap in foil or wax paper wraps. All right, now that we're all nice and hungry, let's turn to Paula Reese's article, 5 COVID-Friendly Trips Across Iowa. If canceled cruises or the travel ban to Europe has you down this summer, don't overlook the fun you can have close to home. You may not feel safe venturing across the country, but we've come up with 5 different COVID-friendly trips across the state that can get you out of the house and exploring Iowa. First, Clear Lake. For that resort town feeling in Iowa, visit Clear Lake, where the beaches are open for swimming and the lake offers many recreational activities, from fishing to boating and watercraft rental. Choose from 3 different public beach access points, one of which includes a just-open splash pad, or stay as a guest at a resort or other accommodation that offers private beach access. Explore history by visiting the crash site of The Day the Music Died, where a stainless steel guitar and set of 3 stainless steel records mark the spot where the plane carrying Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and J.P. the Big Bopper Richardson crashed following their final performance at the Surf Ballroom. You'll also want to check out the Clear Lake Fire Museum, built by members of the Clear Lake Volunteer Fire Department to represent an early 1900s fire station. Sit atop an antique fire truck and learn about the history of firefighting. Don't miss the 9/11 memorial, which includes a salvaged steel beam from the World Trade Center. Learn more about things to do at clearlakeiowa.com. After a day of playing in the sun or exploring history, cool off with a cold one from Lake Time Brewery, featuring socially distanced indoor and outdoor seating and locally favorite beers like the Iowa Nice Light Lager or the On the Rocks Margarita Ale. Just a half hour north in Lake Mills is 5 Alarm Brewing Company, a brewery owned and operated by local volunteer firefighters. With plenty of room to spread out and huge tables along with games like shuffleboard, bags, and ping pong in the basement, you don't have to worry about feeling crowded. Check out the map with patches from firefighters from across the state and beyond, as well as the fire equipment and photos. And try a flight of beers to choose your favorite, including the most popular blueberry wheat, which you can grab in a 6-pack to go. Decorah. Love to bike? Take a road trip to Decorah to try out the newly finished Trout Run Trail following the Upper Iowa River. The last piece of the 11-mile loop was the bridge over Highway 9, which is outfitted with special LED lighting that will change colors throughout the year. The trail crosses trout streams 5 times and runs next to the Decorah Trout Hatchery, the 2nd largest trout hatchery in Iowa. Make a stop at the DNR Trout Hatchery at Sewer Springs and let the kids feed the fish for just a quarter. Don't forget to look up while on the trail to see the famous Decorah Eagle's Nest with its live cam at raptorresource.org. Continue the outdoor fun by taking a short trip to Dunning Springs Park to see the 200-foot waterfall just a few minutes from downtown Decorah. The waterfall is accessible to persons with disabilities and includes an area for picnicking as well as trails. The park is located on Ice Cave Road. For a luxurious stay, book a room at the Hotel Winneshiek, a historic boutique hotel over a century old in the heart of downtown Decorah. Enjoy 21st century comfort with 19th century charm in one of 34 rooms and suites. On-site dining and bar options make it a truly full-service hotel with walking access to shops and other downtown attractions. Extra precautions are being taken to provide the ultimate safety for guests, including reduction of high-touch items in rooms and an advanced electrostatic disinfecting process. Another place to visit is Dubuque. Dubuque has much to offer for couples and families. The National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium brings the history of the Mississippi River to life with indoor and outdoor exhibits and experiences. Now through September 7th, the Robot Zoo is included with admission, featuring 8 robotic animals and more than a dozen hands-on activities that illustrate animal characteristics, from how a chameleon changes colors to how a giant squid propels itself. The 4D movie theater is open, with an additional ticket required. Becky Jones-Webb and her daughter Nova from Osceola recently visited the museum and aquarium and reported feeling very safe. Quote, staff wore masks and almost everyone visiting wore them too, said Jones-Webb. The museum created paths to keep the light traffic away from one another. End quote. Daily creature features, animal touch experiences, and public animal feedings have been suspended for the safety of the animals, and Riverworks splash zone boats have been removed from the water for the safety of patrons. Enjoy the beauty of Dubuque, by exploring the mines of Spain, where you can hike several scenic trails, including the iconic Horseshoe Bluff Nature Trail that overlooks the Mississippi River. Don't miss the paved ADA walkway where you can see trees from all 50 states. And a trip to the mines of Spain wouldn't be complete without a visit to one of Dubuque's most famous landmarks, the Julian Dubuque Monument, which sits atop a limestone bluff and serves as the resting place for the founder of Dubuque, who established a relationship with the original inhabitants of the land, the Meskwaki. Since 2016, nearly 40 murals have popped up in Dubuque, all a collaboration between a nonprofit organization and the local art community, who have reached out to the world-renowned artists to help make the Dubuque cultural landscape something unique. Explore downtown and take photos in front of your favorite vibrant murals. Get a map of all the artwork and learn more at Travel Dubuque's website at www.traveldubuque.com. The fourth featured destination is Sioux City. Experience the Los Hills near Sioux City. The Dorothy Picot Nature Center in the scenic Stone State Park is now open with a limit of 30 visitors at a time and the requirement of staying 6 feet apart, the length of a white-tailed deer. The unique indoor and outdoor exhibits offer educational opportunities for kids and adults, including interactive prairie, wetland, and woodland exhibits, Los Hills Natural History exhibits, a bird viewing area, outdoor children's playscape, trails, and scenic viewpoints, and more. Located on Sioux City's riverfront, the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center and Betty Strong Encounter Center features exhibits showcasing the core of Discovery's time in the area, with the death and burial of Sergeant Charles Floyd at the center of the story. Floyd was the first U.S. soldier to die west of the Mississippi River. Watch presentations on explorations and native cultures, and don't miss the 14-foot-tall bronze Spirit of Discovery sculpture depicting Lewis, Clark, and Lewis's dog, Seaman. Find out more at SiouxCityLCIC.com. Let the kids blow off some steam in a safe and educational environment at the Launchpad Children's Museum. Exhibits include building and engineering activities, a flight zone, and the museum's signature exhibit, the water table, signifying the importance of rivers to the Siouxland area and allowing visitors to discover and experiment. To ensure the safety of all visitors, the Launchpad is asking patrons to reserve a time slot with only 50 visitors being allowed at one time. Masks are encouraged, and temperatures of visitors will be taken by staff before entering. Museum staff will also be establishing strict cleaning and disinfecting procedures. Executive Director Ruline Gartner said, quote, "As always, the health and safety of our guests and children is our number one priority. We will continue to strive to create the best atmosphere for play and discovery. We don't want to change things around for the kids too much, so the Launchpad will do our best to make these adjustments without altering their ability to learn and play." Learn more at launchpadmuseum.com. And finally, Lake Rathbun. If you're looking to stay at a resort but nervous about COVID-19, take a look at Honey Creek Resort on Lake Rathbun in southern Iowa. The resort, which includes a lodge with 105 rooms, 28 cottages, and an RV park, has taken extra precautions to ensure the safety of its guests, including requiring face masks in all indoor and public spaces, and additional social distancing guidelines in the indoor water park and restaurant. During your stay, enjoy the outdoor aqua park, rent kayaks or other watercraft, go fishing, or play a round of golf at the preserve. Take a short drive to Centerville or Albia for a little shopping. Lula's Bakery and Coffee Shop in Centerville is a favorite, baking cookies and cupcakes from scratch. They even offer gluten-free cupcakes. Look for the hot pink building on the southwest side of the historical Centerville Square. In Albia, walk the square for stops at Inspire You All Things Good, Benton Avenue Boutique, and Mustard Seed Company Gift Shop. Turning to business news, Lee Rood of the Register reports no return. Fairway refuses to take empty cans and bottles despite lifting of governor's order. Fairway stores across Iowa do not require customer to wear masks, though a growing number of retailers are mandating them as COVID-19 cases rise. But the grocery chain announced this week it will continue to suspend can and bottle redemption at its stores in the state because of health and safety concerns, angering some customers. The announcement came after Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds last week lifted part of an emergency declaration that had allowed stores since March to suspend redemption of cans and bottles for the 5-cent deposit required under state law. In a statement posted to Facebook, Fairway said it was declining to resume redemption, quote, to minimize potential harm to the communities we serve, end quote. Quote, health authorities continue to advise that COVID-19 and other viruses are transmitted through respiratory droplets, it said in the statement. Quote, accepting potentially contaminated containers inside our stores presents a great risk of harm to the health and safety of our employees and customers, end quote. It also said in its statement that, quote, allowing used containers to be returned in our stores puts our employees and customers at risk and runs counterproductive to the many safety and sanitation initiatives we have implemented in order to keep people safe, end quote. The chain said each store has posted a notice directing customers to nearby redemption centers where they can take their cans and bottles. Quote, we encourage local communities to focus their redemption on supporting these businesses and/or area nonprofits that provide outside collection bins for donation, the statement said. Fairway's announcement triggered hundreds of comments on its Facebook page, debate over the chain's intentions, questions about the legality of refusing to redeem containers, and lots of comments, pro and con, about mask wearing. And now it's time for us to turn to Dear Abby. Today's column is titled, Woman Feels Ashamed, Wants to Apologize to Ex. Dear Abby, is it ever too late to apologize to an ex-boyfriend? I'm in my mid-40s now, and over the last 3 years, I have gone through a significant change. It has made me a much happier person. One of the results of this change is realizing how much I dislike who I was when I was younger. I'm sure many people made mistakes in their early 20s and maybe blew it off, because I know I did. But now I can't. I'm ashamed of my previous behavior and have been thinking about reaching out to him to apologize for the horrible things I did while we were together. My family says I shouldn't do it. They say I'm being ridiculous because, quote, who cares about how an old partner treated you decades ago, end quote. But I'm struggling with letting it go. I learned years ago to take responsibility for my mistakes, but it's something I didn't do. I'm currently in a solid and happy relationship, which is why I think my family may be so against this. And while I don't know my ex's relationship status, I have no ulterior motives. The person I am today just wants very much to apologize for the person I used to be. What is your neutral advice? Signed, Sorry in the Southwest. Dear Sorry in the Southwest, I don't think it is ever too late to say I'm sorry, and I seriously doubt that an overdue apology for your past behavior would cause problems. Because you feel compelled to offer one, go ahead and do it. You may be pleasantly surprised to find that your former flame recovered from whatever you did and went on with his life as you have with yours. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Des Moines Register for Tuesday, July 28, 2020. You can hear this show again at 6 p.m. and again at 1 a.m. Recordings are available on our website, iowaradioreading.org. All material heard on IRIS is intended for the use of Iowans who are print disabled. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 515-243-6833. You can also call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa, 1-877-404-4747. Once again, we want you to know that our program schedule has changed so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. And the Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with this schedule until further notice. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. It's been a pleasure to read for you today. Stay tuned for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. And thank you for listening to Your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.